Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is it possible to be too careful with your words? The unwritten rules of political correctness call for avoiding language that offends groups or individuals who have been historically marginalized or who are disadvantaged in some way. Terms to describe these groups and individuals have been remade to emphasize empowerment or downplay stigma and to reinforce the humanity of those who are challenged. So we speak of people with disabilities or illnesses rather than labeling them according to those conditions. We look for ways to describe race, sexual orientation, national origin, and even socioeconomic status that do not imply that any one classification is categorically better than another. But critics of political correctness say it can go too far when it's used to shut certain perspectives out of discussions or to indict those who inadvertently cause offense when they do not hold intolerant views. We have three guests here to talk about this today. Sarah McCoria is Senior Research Associate with the Institute for Urban Policy Research at the University of Texas at Dallas. Nicole Stockdale is Deputy Editorial Page Editor for the Dallas Morning News. And Michael Sorrell is President of Paul Quinn College. Welcome, all of you, to Think.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we start our PC conversation, I want to take a moment to talk with you, Michael, about a big announcement at Paul Quinn College today. Among other things, you are set to radically change the way students at your school pay for their education.
Absolutely. So we are fully embracing the work college model, and we're also reducing tuition and fees from $23,800 down to $14,300. So we have made it possible for the average student to graduate from college at Paul Quinn and have less than $10,000 of out-of-pocket expenses at the end of 4 years.
What did it take to figure out that this would work financially?
Well, the first thing it took was just an acknowledgement that we could do better, right? That we have a responsibility in higher education to cater to the needs of our students. 84% of our students are Pell Grant eligible. They don't have a lot of money. They don't have a lot of resources. So we decided that to look for ways to pass the savings of the institution along to them. And it requires a change in the way of doing business. But at the end of the day, it's the best thing for our students. They're going to get two educations. They'll get a great liberal arts education. But they also will have the opportunity to focus on real-world experience through the work program. They'll have 4 years of work experience. We think it's a great way, two educations for the price of one.
Does that start with incoming freshmen next year?
Absolutely. Well, so everyone will go into the work program in the fall. For the past 2 years, we've done a beta test where we've had freshmen and sophomores doing it. So now this is just what's necessary to officially be recognized as a work college.
Well, we'll be excited to follow that as it progresses. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you for asking.
All right, we'll switch back to our regularly scheduled topic. Thinking back to the introduction that I gave, is there anything you would add or take away from those definitions of political correctness? Anything that you've thought about that maybe hasn't come up yet?
Well, I would say working at the Dallas Morning News, it's something that we struggle with all the time because we are a mass market newspaper that has to appeal to such a wide audience. The language that reporters choose to use in their stories is really important because you don't want to detract from the message that the reporters are trying to impart. But on the other hand, you also don't want to be disingenuous with the sources you're using. So it's a debate that we deal with all the time in the newspaper world.
I think one thing that really makes this subject so fascinating to me is that our collective standards change over time. So something that was perfectly appropriate and respectful a generation ago, today we recognize, or many people recognize, to be inappropriate. And so there are even like advocacy organizations that have had to, you know, drop their names back to simply an acronym. How influential are decisions like those on the way that the rest of the country speaks?
This is Sarah. I think that they are very influential because it is establishing a value system by which we live. So language is not neutral. There's power embedded in it. And so I think that the identity politics that play out as we, as different folks say, this is how I live, this is how I want to be addressed, this is how I represent myself, it forces all of us to collectively think about those identities in a different way, in a way that respects their agency.
We know, of course, that it is possible to use perfectly correct language and not necessarily hold particularly tolerant views. But do you think that as a society, we begin to adopt a different language that is striving to be tolerant, does that ultimately have an effect on how people think?
Well, I think it does. The reality of it is you have to start somewhere. And, you know, it wasn't that long ago that people were using words that were completely offensive as everyday part of just a part of their everyday lives. And now you see a more conscious effort to be more understanding. But at the same time, it has come with a significant backlash. I mean, there are lots of things that are occurring now that are just as unspeakable as they would have been 20, 30, 40 years ago. They're just couched in different language, and that's problematic as well.
So in some cases, political correctness gives people cover to hold those views but say the right things.
I think what's been particularly interesting is to watch the co-opting of the language of the civil rights movement mm-hmm. by right-wing organizations. I mean, that is, you know, incredibly uncomfortable. It's painful, and it's a little bit scary.
And the same for the radical left, with liberals co-opting a lot of that language, right? I mean, you see organizations that are not politically progressive using that language that people associate with certain ideals and moving towards that. So it happens on a lot of different levels.
By definition, is the language of political correctness something that empowers the left over the right?
How so?
Well, I mean, is political correctness something? Certainly, it seems to have sprung up among people who were left-leaning thinkers. Are we asking people on the right to think like people on the left when we insist that everyone use politically correct language?
Well, I don't know if I think both extremes attempt to drive people to their point of view, right? And I think that there's a certain language that the right wing use that makes people uncomfortable. And I think that there's probably language that the left wing uses that makes them uncomfortable. I mean, the reality of it is neither one of them are overly interested in finding a common ground.
Right.
Right. I mean, that defeats their whole purposes. And the reality is life is lived in the middle, and we have to find ways to coexist. And to the extent that our language doesn't allow us to do that, I think that becomes problematic. But I also think the insincere use of the language is equally as problematic.
And I think that's a good point, right? At the heart of it is, what does it mean and what does it look like to coexist? So, and I'm not picking on you or the Dallas Morning News, but for example, when there's an officer-involved shooting, right? When we say that, or when we read that an unarmed black or brown or mentally ill person is a suspect rather than a victim, that's codified language that has a power implication that sides with one side, i.e. the police department, and not with that person. So you, as a person at home, reads that and thinks, what did they do wrong? Or what was the issue with that person? Instead of, maybe there was a confrontation that the police officer was wrong. And so then when we see that we haven't had an indictment of an officer in 40 years, that language plays into that dynamic, that political and power dynamic. And so I think what it means to coexist, we use language as a frontier of navigating that. But I think often we don't talk about the power in it, in the power in the language.
So what do you do, Nicole, in cases where someone who is assaulted by a police officer could be both a victim and a suspect simultaneously?
Absolutely. So that's the kind of conundrum that we find ourselves in every day. And you can't choose sides because you don't know the whole story. And most of the time you have a reporter who has the facts as presented to them. And so you do the best that you can in a short amount of time to you know, to tell the story as the victim, if you have access to the victim or suspect, as they explain it to you and as the police officers explain it to you. But it is, by its nature, a system that will lean a little bit to the authorities, because that's who's providing the information, and you don't always have such quick access to the other side of the story. So it's one reason why we have to be very careful to police ourselves. You might find the flip side of this argument in how newspapers deal with people who are in the country illegally. And there's been a big debate, especially here in North Texas, about the language that the newspaper might use. Do you call them an undocumented immigrant, or do you call them an illegal immigrant? And
AP made a different call a couple years ago.
When the Associated Press changed its style, the Dallas Morning News followed that style and switched from illegal immigrant to undocumented immigrant. But there are cries from, you know, many people on the right saying that that is in itself political correctness run amok, and that you are not that you're whitewashing what immigrants are by using that language. And so it certainly is something that cuts both ways, and it is impossible to please everyone. So you try to do the best that you can.
So this is what's interesting, right? I mean, on one point, social media has changed how we engage, because you can move to tell your side of the story directly to whatever your constituency is, or, as I like to tell my students, whoever you can get to pay attention to, right? But on the undocumented citizens issue, that is tricky in an entirely different way, right? Because, I mean, I think about it from the standpoint, I mean, I am a licensed attorney. And when things don't comply with the law, there's a terminology for using that. But here we are, making a public policy argument about a legal issue and, you know, in a way, forcing the law to evolve to match our public policy interests, which we have an interest of doing in this country. But it's fascinating to watch it take place in real time. Like, I don't know if we've seen anything during our lifetimes where the needle is moving as much.
And, you know, I think at the heart of that debate, right, is to call somebody illegal is very offensive, right? They might have done an illegal act, but they are not illegal. They are undocumented. They are people who are here undocumented. And so actually that term is just better suited and fitted for the actual act and the people, you know, because to say, you know, if somebody commits a crime, they don't walk around for the rest of their life. Actually, they do in a lot of cases. But we don't say criminal, right? Or we don't create that into a noun, right? And so
We call them a felon, and we don't let them vote.
And that's just as problematic, right? And so I think that that's where we really get to this place where the language and the power, the connection between those two comes to head, because it is an issue. I mean, we were walking in, and I'm not picking on her either, but the intern was saying, okay, you guys, you're going to sit over here and you're going to be in the conference room, and then I'll call you guys in. Well, we were just two females and we're two women. And so by calling us guys, what do you lose in terms of who we are, and how does that play into the whole spectrum of gender dynamics? So it's interesting.
We're speaking about the pros and cons and limitations and powers of political correctness with Sarah McCuria, who is Senior Research Associate with the Institute for Urban Policy Research at the University of Texas at Dallas, Michael Sorrell, who is President of Paul Quinn College, and Nicole Stockdale, Deputy Editorial Page Editor for the Dallas Morning News. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs, accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about political correctness with Nicole Stockdale, Deputy Editorial Page Editor for the Dallas Morning News, Sarah McCoria, Senior Research Associate with the Institute for Urban Policy Research at UTD, and Michael Sorrell, President of Paul Quinn College. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. How do we decide as a society who is allowed to make decisions about appropriate language and who is allowed to police those decisions?
Well, now that we have social media, everybody is allowed to police those decisions.
It's a free-for-all. Yeah.
And I think that's one of the interesting dynamics that makes this so fluid, because you have given a voice to people who have so long been voiceless, and you can immediately have a hashtag campaign that catches on, and you can, muster the millions on social media in a way that you couldn't before. And so the policing aspect is what has really flourished. And I think that's one of the things that was so interesting in the piece by Jonathan Chait that sparked this conversation most recently, is that you have that in large part was what this mainstream journalist was complaining about, is that you have so many people on social media who are able to muster up this force against the establishment, and the establishment is not used to that. And so we have a lot more police officers out there, but that makes it a lot more muddy because you don't know who gets to make those rules.
And it's worth asking who is qualified to weigh in on particular topics. You know, this idea, can a man write legitimately about the experiences of women? Does a straight person have the right to explain something about gay culture? And I think those are all interesting questions as we try to figure out how to talk about these things.
Yeah, I think that. So, you know, as an African-American male, I like to think of it a little bit differently. I am always leery of the tyranny of the majority, because it wasn't that long ago that the majority wouldn't let me use the same restaurants or restrooms or anything like that. And so when we talk about who has the power, I think power is a very tricky concept. And in terms of who makes the decision, I can't write off an Anglo person's ability to advocate for race relations, because then I'm ignoring the history of race relations in this country. The abolitionists who put their lives on the line to help gain the end of slavery and things of that nature. So I think you have to be mindful. I think you have to be respectful. What we teach our students at Paul Quinn College is that you can be our kind and not be our color. Right? So to me, I want to know what your value system is. Now, if you have the right value system, then chances are you can be an effective advocate. And since I'm sitting here with two women for gender issues, but I also have to concede the space that I'm not the expert, right? That I can be a supporter, that I can lend my voice and my power and my authority. But at all times, I have to constantly be in a place where I'm questioning myself and be open to the criticism that may come that I'm not doing a very good job with it. Doesn't mean I shouldn't advocate for it, but it means I need to be respectful in my role as a supporter of those causes.
Running through all of this is, in my mind, is the recent research about unconscious bias, which is like maybe the most deflating, sad thing that, researchers who are doing this work have said. I've taken these tests and have found things about my sort of unconscious, maybe atavistic attitudes about things that people don't want to have these beliefs. They don't act on them, but they sort of exist at a level in a lot of people. What do we do about that with regard to the way we speak and with regard to this need to always be on guard and yet to, you know, function like a regular person and move through the world without constantly, checking ourselves?
Well, we're talking about this in negative terms, like policing and being on guard, rather than the exciting and possibilities that come with being able to grow and change in these ways, right? As more folks have a voice and have agency and are naming themselves, it's a new way of seeing the world, and it forces all of us to think about things and act in different ways. And so for me, even though it can sometimes be an uncomfortable experience, it's exciting. It's expanding my brain and my reality rather than limiting me or forcing me to, I don't feel policed. I feel excited about learning new ways to think about people, whether it be along gender lines, along racial lines. Especially in my work, I've worked with people of all different cultures, all different ways of thinking, and that's expanded my life and it enriches my life rather than making me feel like, oh no, I'm being attacked. You know, I'm learning new values.
But is there any? I mean, I think an interesting part of this conversation is whether that can ever go too far. In the way that you describe it, it is very, you know, life affirming for people who we get to talk about in ways that are more comfortable for identifiers for them. But, you know, there have been a lot of instances, and a lot of what this debate has been about lately has been where people see political correctness gone too far, where there is, when there are efforts to change someone's life, make sure they get fired from a job because they've used a certain term. There was a great article in the New York Times this weekend about the tweet that got Justine Sacco fired. And, you know, there is something about it, you know, a lot of it is social media, but there is a power to be harnessed that says that if you make one mistake, you are not politically correct in one tweet, that your life should, you know, the social media mob should come after you. And I think, you know, that's where I have the most difficulty navigating. How much of that, you know, that seems to be too far to me. On the other hand, it is a force for good. So where do you find that middle sweet spot?
So I want to play devil's advocate for a second. So I tend to think about it like this. When I see a tweet that's out of hand, I look at the context and I look at the person's body of work. All right. And so what I have come to discover is the people who get in a lot of trouble isn't the ones who actually made one mistake. All right. It's that the one mistake leads you to do some more investigating and you discover things that it's like that just wasn't really one mistake. And so I wonder if that's not part of it. Mm-hmm. All right. I mean, I think, look, there is such a thing as paralysis by analysis, you know, that we can think so long and so hard, well, like what's right, what's wrong. I tell my students all the time, like, I'm going to get some stuff wrong, all right? Like, I'm going to say something that might make you uncomfortable. But one, I'm open to learning. So if I do that, tell me, all right? Give me an opportunity to explain myself. I'll give you an opportunity to explain yourself. But what happens is we have these conversations in a vacuum, and folks haven't taken the time, and there's not a safe place to have them. And so they feel offended, you know, or the other side of it is it was just the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
Right. And I think the people who feel most uncomfortable or attacked in this are people who have traditionally enjoyed inherited power, right? That there was no competition. There was no voice against. And so it's difficult to lose that, or I can imagine so. But
right, because we didn't have it,
yeah.
Right?
So,
what do you make of there is absolutely, I think, genuine outrage when people say things that are offensive, particularly if there is offensive intent behind them. There is also kind of this, like, in some, you know, corners of the internet, there is this gleeful ability to jump on someone who has said something that is offensive. And I think it has something to do with saying this is not okay. This kind of language hurts people. And it also has something to do with saying, look how open-minded and tolerant I am. And there's sometimes a kind of a self-congratulatory nature to this. What do we do with that? you don't have to agree with that assessment. That's been my sense in reading some things, you know?
Well, I think it's true. I think it's there and you see it. And I think that if you didn't have that aspect of the self-congratulatory nature, you wouldn't have people who glommed on so quickly to causes that, you know, like Michael said it's important to know the context, and that may be impossible. It is impossible in a tweet. That's what tweets are all about. There's 140 characters, which provides no context. And so most people aren't doing any digging into tweets to find out if this is an upstanding member of our community or if it's just someone that we need to, you know, make sure gets fired from her job. But it's easy to retweet. It's easy to feel superior. It's easy to share the outrage with everybody else who is outraged and to know that they would never do anything like this.
And I should be clear, I'm talking here about people who are privileged, you know, having this sense that, like, all the other people are bad, but I'm good, you know?
Well, you know, the jerks are jerks. Right? Whether you're on social media or it's a conversation, you can't hide being a jerk.
Let's talk about humor, which can be a really powerful tool to explore things that make us uncomfortable. But then there are questions about, you know, what's okay to laugh at? What's okay to laugh at if you sort of have had this experience? How should we look at works of humor that are designed to be provocative?
You know, I was thinking about that this morning. I think that it's all about context, right? So what if I pay to go to a comedy club and I see a comedian and a lot of times a lot of the jokes are offensive, I'm choosing to be there, right? Mm-hmm. And I have the right to leave. But if I am in my workplace, if I'm in my son's school, if I'm dealing with the city council, I have different expectations, and I think there are different rules that apply within that and within that public sphere. So it's, for me, it's all about context.
But even with professional comedians, you can cross the line. I think we saw that with Michael Richards when he used inappropriate language that in the way that he used it, people found offensive and not funny, and he was pilloried, and some people thought that was right and some people thought that was wrong. But there is certainly there is some invisible line, and I think that there are a lot of professional comedians who feel like they don't know where that line is and that it is inhibiting their creativity to try out new jokes and to see if things are funny. You can go out to a comedy club and bomb one night, and instead of it just being you bombing one night, it is now being posted on YouTube, and it could hurt your career in, you know, indeterminably. So I think that's an interesting aspect of it too. It's hard to know whether you're breaking the rules when no one is quite sure what the rules are.
Well, and it's an evolution of political correctness and offensive language. So when I think about comedians and I look at someone like Richard Pryor, who used a horribly offensive language.
But he went back and forth with that language.
But he did go back and forth with that language. And he also pushed forward a conversation that needed to be had, right?
Exactly.
I mean, a lot of people don't realize Dick Gregory started out as a comedian, right? I mean, and even, I mean, look, Dave Chappelle for all of his ups and downs. I mean, so when you look at people and you realize the types of conversations that are being had and how you're pushing the needle forward, I don't know how you find that line, right? Because to me, the nature of comedy is trespassing on those lines.
Mm-hmm. You have to push other people's lines forward.
Right.
But I think to your point, in all three of those examples, there was a cultural and political analysis embedded in
Absolutely.
That comedy. Whereas
it was smart comedy.
Right. Mm-hmm. Whereas some of the comedians who've gotten in trouble have just been plain racist, right? They're not making a statement about how we can think about life and identity and race politics in a different way. They've been just purely offensive and racist and derogatory, which is different for me. That's the line for me.
So this is fascinating to me. One of the things that I have noticed is in athletics, right? So Riley Cooper is caught on videotape calling a security guard at a concert the N-word. Right. I don't know how, if you're a teammate of his in the Philadelphia Eagles, that you just brush that off.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, to me,
Riley Cooper is white.
Yeah. Riley Cooper's a white wide receiver of the Philadelphia Eagles. Pretty good football player. Right. But that that wasn't the first time he used that language, right? Like, you could see it in the video. It wasn't as if he thought for a second before he said it, or, I mean, it came rolling out, right? What do you do in that situation, right? I mean, and if you would believe what was put out about that, you know, they talked about it, they had a team meeting, and everything was, you know, fine and dandy after that.
Not so sure.
Well, so I guess that brings up the bigger conversation for me, which is language is one frontier, but the bigger frontier, which we don't talk about it as much, is the systematic change. So we don't talk about the systematic racism, sexism, homophobia that exists within our culture. And we get caught up and tangled in conversations about language or failures as individuals and don't see the systematic nature of these issues, which play a bigger role in our lived realities. And so I think that needs to be the next conversation and really at the forefront. When we have those conversations, I think we'll start seeing more change.
So it seems like people who have not been privileged by these systems historically are quite well aware of where the advantage and disadvantage lies. But so often people who have just taken it for granted that this is not some special privilege, but this is just the way things are, have much more trouble seeing that. What do you do to try to explain those concepts to people without turning everybody into like this state of, you know, defensiveness that kind of shuts down the conversation?
I suggest reading books. I mean, you know, like, honestly, history. It's not, we live in a country that has libraries, that has the internet, and it requires, unfortunately, we don't have a school system that teaches real strong history that includes all the different identities of this country as American history. We don't get that in school, so I understand why some folks have a level of ignorance. But I also think as an adult, you have to take that agency and educate yourself.
We're speaking this hour with Sarah McCuria, who is Senior Research Associate with the Institute for Urban Policy Research at the University of Texas at Dallas, Michael Sorrell, President of Paul Quinn College, and Nicole Stockdale, Deputy Editorial Page Editor for the Dallas Morning News. Our topic is political correctness. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about political correctness with Paul Quinn College President Michael Sorrell, Deputy Editorial Page Editor for the Dallas Morning News, Nicole Stockdale, and Sarah McCuria, who is Senior Research Associate with the Institute for Urban Policy Research at UTD. So, Sarah, before the break, you were saying that reading history is important, and it's important to sort of know where we've all come from as a collective culture and also as sort of individual subcultures. But of course, there are those people who can read a work of history and frown and sort of shake their finger at people in the past and see no connection whatsoever to that.
I think a great example of that is how different people have their views on the Civil War. And you see people who are great experts in history on both sides of a debate who cannot come to any common ground on whether, you know, states are allowed to secede and what the Civil War means for Southern states and whether we should have Confederate holidays and we should honor Confederate generals. And so I don't know that being aware of the history is enough to have people find common ground, because many times their interpretation is just so different. That's not enough.
What should we do when we have been offended by something that someone has said, whether, I mean, it's easier to know what to do when someone has deliberately said something that crosses a line and has intended to offend us. It's another maybe stickier situation when someone has just said something that is kind of blind but has not necessarily been intended to offend.
Well, what I teach my students and what I try to practice in my own life is teachable moments, you know, and sometimes that requires a conversation in front of a group, and sometimes it's talking to that person individually, and it takes discernment to decide what the best course is. But I think too often we do not have those conversations. We talk about it afterward. Can you believe right. he said that or she said that? And we don't take that moment to educate that person, to have a dialogue, to have a conversation. Or, you know, a lot of times there's just bystanders. People experience something, don't say anything, may not laugh, but just stand silently, and that's condoning it. That's saying that that's acceptable. And so I think you don't want to become the person who's out with your wand looking for arguments, but that's part of our responsibility to hold each other accountable in love.
So I look at it from sort of a cost-benefit analysis, right? If I'm having a conversation with someone, and we'll just take an example. Let's say that the person's 80 years old, and they say something that, you know, I mean, we're not talking about a huge, you just called me the N-word, and things have now got to go to a completely different place. But let's say something that just shows that they're from a different era, and it just, that's a different conversation than I'm going to have with someone who is, say, 20, and it's a really teachable moment, to your point. I mean, there are ways in which everyone can have a teachable moment. If you're 80 and you want to talk about your colored friends, right? I wish you wouldn't.
Do you even say anything at that point, knowing that you're unlikely to change the way they communicate?
Well, listen, I'm 6'4 and 225 pounds. If I say something, they might have a heart attack, and I don't want that on my conscience, right?
We're so, being ageist here. I think
I'm a work in progress, right? Yeah. I admit I'm a work in progress.
We all
but
are.
My point is that I think you handle situations differently, and you've got to use some form of common sense, right? Now, I mean, is there an element of ageism? Absolutely. I cannot deny that there is an element of that in how I conduct those conversations. But I go back to your point. I think that's discernment, and it's a tough call.
You're
never going to get it all right.
The language has a context. So if you grew up in a context and this is the way folks have spoken, and that might be where your language is coming from, there's more of an understanding than, as you say, a 19 or 20-year-old using that same language. But I do think we all have the ability to learn, and it just depends on the nature of your relationship as well. What do you hope to achieve by having that conversation? Is it really a teachable moment, or is it a moment to just bash someone over the head and say you're wrong? What's gained out of it?
And you have to know your audience, because there is an art to how you approach those situations in a way that will not make people immediately shut down. If you are talking to people, I mean, I think that's part of what this PC debate is about. How do you make people empathize with others when their natural instinct may be to be defensive? And so if you go nuclear on someone because they have, you know, called someone disabled, that's not the best way to approach it. If you want them to think about why the terms that they used could be offensive.
See, but Nicole raises a point that I think is really going to be interesting moving forward. And that's this. How do we even have those conversations? Right? So let's just play this out. And if you want to have that conversation, you've got to give people permission to be awkward in having the conversation so you can move the conversation forward. You have to acknowledge you're going to make some mistakes, but we're going to have this in a safe place. And because that's the only way you begin to get it right, right? I mean, look, my family raised me with an extreme culture of chivalry, right? I mean, no ifs, ands, buts, but now there's a fine line between chivalry and sexism, mm-hmm. okay? And I'm positive that I'm all over the place on that line, right? But if every woman that I open a door for or that I practice what my parents taught me jumps down my throat and yells at me about it, you know, that's not going to help our cause, right? We're better served with, you know, me being thoughtful and intentional and people working on those concepts, right? But, you know, one of the conversations that I think is really tricky is how you have those difficult social issue conversations in a place where people can actually have them and benefit from them, as opposed to having them in a way where you're like, you know what? Forget you, and I'm going to shut down.
Well, I think there's a spectrum, right? Some of those conversations are require safe space and are more difficult, and some can even be comedic. I was at a sandwich shop, and there was a man in front of me and a man behind me, and we were all ordering, and the first man orders, and he said, what can I get you, boss? And then he asked me, ma'am, what would you like? And the next guy was, what can I get you, boss? And I said, I'm a boss too, you know, and everybody laughed. But it was a social commentary on what is a female's role and how do you address me as well? So I didn't create a safe space and bring everybody into that, but I was able to still make a comment about the language use, and I haven't been back to know, you know, at the end, the cashier was like, all right, boss, you know, everybody made a joke of it, and I think we can have those moments throughout life when people respond to all women as guys, or when people make offensive language around race or class or ability, we can do it in a way that isn't mean and combative, but in a more positive and productive way.
So I'm curious, and I want to ask this in the safest way possible. But
this is a safe space.
Safe space.
This is a safe space.
Not over here.
I'm not surprised. No, but it is, Sarah. How do you not become exhausted? Right? Because I mean, literally. If you are dealing with it on that granular of a level, then every interaction becomes an opportunity for those types of conversations. Like, how do you not become exhausted or jaded or angry or any of that?
Well, it is exhausting. And I have my moments where it's just, why, God, you know, is this the context? And why are we in this space and time? And why is it like that? But my optimism, my hope is through activism and fighting for systematic change, because that's all I see that I can do. If I have a 4-year-old, so for my son, if he grows up in this city and, like Clinton Allen, has to meet a white officer in the street and killed, shot 7 times, twice in the back, just because of his race, I failed, right? And so across the board, from the education system on an identity politics and racism, all of that is why I fight. And that is why I feel all of us should do. That's our moral responsibility is to do that. That's the work. That's the work that we're put on this earth to do, that's what I believe. So it's exhausting, but it's the burden I carry.
No, it's very interesting. So we, at Paul Quinn, we carry that same burden for a different cause, right? Like, I think the economic circumstances of the southern part of the city is an embarrassment to everyone who lives in this city.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, I mean, I think it's a third world country. And so the fight for doing that every day, and I'm asking you that partially out of selfish reasons, mm-hmm. because it is exhausting, right? I mean, you put on your armor every day. you go to work. Like, you know, it's 8 years. We still don't have a grocery store, right? I mean, there's still stray dogs running around the community. And you have your victories, but you're not, the war isn't won yet, right? And so when I know what I tell my students, but I was just curious about the perspective of someone else and how they view their fight. So that was very helpful. Thank you.
And also for me, I've had to come to a space where I understand my own limitations as a human being, right? I see the issues across the board, and I recognize I'm not helpful by trying to fight every fight. So how can I be an ally? How can I be a collaborator? How can I be part of coalitions and focus my energy and attention where I'm best suited? One of my biggest passions is public education in Dallas. I haven't been as active in the last 3 years because there are other folks who are doing a really great job. And so it's knowing how to step back and step in, you know, how I can be most impactful, most successful. And so knowing that limitation is how I keep myself in balance.
Do you all ever engage in online discussions of these issues? The kind that are sort of maybe this is a question for you, Nicole, mm-hmm. but the comments at the end of a story or of a report of some kind, and like, is there a way to make those positive? I see people trying. I see people saying, hey, let's be civil here and talk about these things. And I see some people sort of saying ridiculously awful, hateful things. And I see other people saying things that might be ignorant or hurtful, but not intentionally so. So is there a way to throw ourselves into those interactions in a really productive way?
Well, I mean, talk about exhausting. And there's no limit on the number of online conversations that are out there, or even online comments at DallasNews.com, for example, where I work. And so we are physically unable to respond to every comment and to insert ourselves in every conversation on Twitter or on Facebook. There are too many of those and not enough of us. But we do insert ourselves when we find places that are appropriate, either correcting the record in the worst of the worst, or if you happen to be in a space where there are misperceptions being pushed forward, then it's definitely our responsibility to jump in where we can and try to make those a more productive place for commentary to take place. That is much easier said than done, though, because there is just an inexhaustible level of commentary coming in. So I think that's it's a real challenge, and it's a challenge for publishing companies, but it's also a challenge for just Facebook and Twitter and anyone who involves themselves online. You never know what's going to be thrown at you, and it may not be worth it to hop in the fray.
Nicole Stockdale is Deputy Editorial Page Editor for the Dallas Morning News. Sarah McCuria is Senior Research Associate with the Institute for Urban Policy Research at the University of Texas at Dallas. Michael Sorrell is President of Paul Quinn College. It has been such a pleasure to have all three of you here today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.